Welcome to the Alpha Mind Podcast with me, Stephen Goldstein, and my co-host, Mark Randall. In this podcast, we hold fascinating conversations with people from the world of financial markets and from related areas. In this series, we delve into the lives and stories of extraordinary guests whose experiences give us a fresh and powerful lens through which to understand the mental, emotional, psychological, and behavioral challenges people face when encountering risk, uncertainty, and complexity within financial markets. Today, we are delighted to have with us John McCaskill. John is currently in the US Navy and is a former Naval SEAL commander. John has served for over 23 years. Currently, he is coming to the end of his naval career and is transitioning out of the Navy. John currently teaches mindfulness and meditation to Navy veterans in a program called Veterans Path. In this podcast, John will share with us how mindfulness and meditation can be used to improve performance when involved in traumatic, complex, and uncertain environments and jobs. Now, currently, at the time of recording this, we had just started to move into the coronavirus panic. And as we have seen over the past couple of weeks, that has spiraled completely out of control. And there's an enormous amount of anxiety and stress in society at the moment, as well as within the trading community with some of the dramatic moves we've had in financial markets. Now, we know mindfulness is a powerful technique which helps people focus and become more present and aware. And it's something which helps improve performance, helps develop resilience, and helps people to deal with anxiety and stress. And anyone who uses this can become far better and far more effective if they use it and practice it well and correctly. It was a real pleasure to talk to John. Here are a few clips from the podcast.
The military is starting to implement this in special operations, and we're also starting to implement it even in our general forces as part of boot camp even. It develops your resilience so that when you are faced with adversity, when you are faced with stress, when you are faced with anxiety, you already know what you can tap into to handle those stressors. Another term for mindfulness is situational awareness. Situational awareness, you're trying to focus on the here and now, right? My situational awareness, because I had wired my brain to be a certain way, I would have been paying more attention on the battlefield. I would have known where my men were in a better way. That's one of the whole points behind the practice, is that it does help to quiet the mind.
Before the interview, quick thank you to our sponsor, the Society of Technical Analysts, the STA. The STA is one of the world's leading bodies in the field of technical analysis education. You can find out more about them and their services by visiting their website, sta-uk.org. Now, on with the podcast.
John McCaskill. I am wrapping up a 23-year U.S. Navy career. I'm actually still in the military, but will be getting out of the Navy here in August of 2020. In the interim between now and then, I've actually been blessed to serve in an internship role with a nonprofit called Veterans Path. Veterans Path, we introduce former military service members to the life-changing and life-saving practices of mindfulness and meditation. The word path in our name comes from peace, acceptance, transformation, and honor. And that's what we hope to bring veterans, is that sense of peace, acceptance, transformation, and honor. And they have helped hundreds of veterans find that sense of peace, acceptance, transformation, and honor. So it's an honor, no pun intended there, to be involved with them now. And we can get into that story later in the podcast about how that came to be. As far as who I am personally, I live in Virginia Beach, Virginia, in the U.S., and I am married with two little kids. I've got a three-year-old little girl and a little boy. So that's my quick down and dirty.
I was going to ask, John, I mean, what brought you to mindfulness? Was that a relatively recent part of your story, or is it something that's kind of always been there ticking around and you've now just obviously clarified it with this move to Veterans Path?
Oh no, absolutely not. It's definitely more recent. And when I say recent, it's relative, within the last 3 years. In the military, I had a series of ups and downs, and I battled with stress and anxiety and depression, quite honestly. And in my time in the Navy, I was given different medications to deal with that stress, anxiety, and depression. And I was meeting with different counselors and psychiatrists, psychologists, and they ended up recommending, one of them finally ended up recommending mindfulness and meditation. And in all honesty, I mean, I had heard of meditation in the past, hadn't ever practiced it, didn't think that I could practice it. I thought that my mind was too busy. Plus, I also had this kind of stigma or in my mind or a stereotype of what a meditator, the profile that they fit. And I didn't feel that I fit that profile. And then mindfulness, I didn't feel I knew anything about that or what that was. So he had to convince me of the science and the physiology of mindfulness and meditation and what actually is happening there. And once he kind of showed me that, and then he explained the benefits of practice, and he showed me some very high performing individuals who practice, then I was sold on it, or at least initially. So I went home for about 2 weeks and I was practicing regularly for that 2 weeks. And then I went back to him and I didn't see the positive effects that he had promised me. And he kind of laughed at me and said, "Well, that's like going to the gym for 2 weeks and expecting that you're going to be able to be a superhero or look like Arnold Schwarzenegger. You're not going to be able to feel these effects for a while. It takes some work." So I took that back home and practiced for another 6 or 8 weeks. And after doing so, I did start to see the effects and how I was handling stress and how I was dealing with anxiety and depression. And people soon after that, they started seeing it in me and they started asking me what I was doing differently. And it was basically at that point when I realized that I could actually teach this and help to share these practices with others because they had become so valuable in my life in such a short time. And when I say such a short time, by the time somebody started asking me what I was doing differently, it was probably 6 months or so that I had been practicing. And that's when people actually started noticing the effects that these practices were having on me and how I was interacting with others, how I was dealing with stress, how I was focused at work, and with family. So that's how I got into it. But Mark, to answer your question, the other part of your question, it definitely was not a part of my life prior to that for multiple reasons, and I touched on them. One is I had that stereotype. I kind of felt that people who meditated were either hippies or they had to dedicate their lives to meditation and, live in a monastery as a monk. And obviously that was me by being extremely naive on my part. Yes, there are people that fit that profile, and that's great, and I have nothing against them. But that's not who I, envision myself to be. But then once that psychologist kind of got me over that stereotype, then I was fine. The other piece that I struggled with was thinking that because my mind was constantly busy, because I was constantly thinking of the next thing, that I couldn't meditate, that was for people who had a lot of time on their hands, had a lot of time to be very introspective, or they had that quiet and calm mind to begin with. And once I realized that even with a mind that races all the time, you can meditate, and not only can you meditate, but doing so helps to quiet the mind. And that's one of the whole points behind the practice, is that it does help to quiet the mind.
I can imagine it's something that obviously the work I do with my sort of corporate focus Mind Fitness, and I wrap it as Mind Fitness to try to get more blokes coming along, because I called it mindfulness, but it does have this sort of stigma, and you're quite right to point that out. But have you come across the work of Joelle and Michelle Levy?
I haven't.
They were funded by the Pentagon to run a Ultimate Warrior Mind Fitness program in late 70s, early 80s. But essentially tune up for people that had the capability of beginning World War III, you know, post-Cold War.
Oh, wow.
And again, it is about managing self. It is about managing the chaos of thoughts and getting clarity for decisions and things like that. And so they were wrapping it up as this Ultimate Warrior program that actually the troops renamed it Jedi Warrior, because they kind of thought that was quite cool at the time, because it was shortly after Star Wars. So the Jedi Warrior program was set. And it was interesting that the softer they got into the mindfulness, so for example, like the compassionate mindfulness, which is on paper sort of almost yucky, but actually it had some of the biggest impact in terms of just opening up this better dialogue with their self, as it were, and actually bringing themselves back for their family post operating in theater. Very, very interesting that, you know, I did a corporate presentation today, and it was probably 70% women. I also went quite recently to there was a big show in London regarding mindfulness, and the audience of 300, there were 290 Anglo-Saxon white females, essentially, and not many blokes. Guys tend to shy away from it because they think it's fluffy. Quite often it's delivered in a fluffy way, which doesn't help, you know, because it sort of matches the stigma. So there is an appetite within the male world from a mental health perspective to actually sort yourself out and get on one of these programs. But of course, if the stigma's there, they're not attracted to it. But wherever you go in the industry, particularly in the UK, you tend to find it loaded in a female sense, particularly in a non-diversified sense as well. So it tends to be very Anglo-Saxon, very middle-aged white female tends to be the people that get on top of this. It's folk like ourselves, and I guess you, John, in your space, and myself in the space I operate here, actually we're doing men a massive service in, I guess, re-engaging with them in a different wrapper, you know, wrapping it and positioning it and the words that go with it sort of stuff. All needs to be in a way that's acceptable, because I'm sure you agree that you can make this look super, super fluffy if you're not careful.
Absolutely.
But the potency, it does weaponize the mind in terms of the potency of working in very, very difficult environments. It becomes a real major tool for you in very short time if you can commit to this type of process.
Can I ask a question to both of you, because you're both practitioners in this area? Is there a sense that a lot of the stuff being taught or being produced is not mindfulness at all? It's quick fix solutions. Like you said, John, earlier on, you know, in a way you went, after 2 weeks, this isn't working. I know a lot of people that say it after 2 minutes, or they buy an app. And they do it for a week, and then they say, "Well, this app's not working." And there's no responsibility on themselves being taken. There's no onus to develop it. And there's a lot of cheap and a lot of bad mindfulness education going on out there. So I want to ask that to both of you, really.
Guess be first.
Yeah, I'm fine either way. I feel as though we're just three men having a conversation. I don't feel as though I'm necessarily a guest. But I will just offer my two cents on that. Is so, Stephen, I did mention earlier that it, you know, it took me several months before I noticed the really long-term positive effects on what I was practicing. I do now believe that there are instant effects as far as being able to slow your heart rate, de-stress as you're tapping into your parasympathetic nervous system. If you're breathing slowly, you can kind of control your breathing. You kind of can control your amygdala and your body's stress response. So in that regard, there is an instant response, positive response, and that it just takes a while to notice that. That said, that can be worked through those very simple apps, but in order to get the long-term effects that I was referencing earlier, really to where you're starting to focus more, de-stress over the whole day or weeks at a time, then that's going to take some accountability on the practitioner's part. You can't practice for 3 days, take a week off, practice for 3 days, take a week off. It's again very much like hitting the gym. You need to have a routine that you get into and continue to practice that. As far as mindfulness and the term itself being used incorrectly in society, people are starting to use mindfulness and meditation synonymously, and they are not the exact same thing. They are not one for one. There's, if you envision a Venn diagram and you've got meditation in one circle of the Venn diagram and you have mindfulness in the other circle, there's definitely overlap between the two, and there's similar benefits that you can experience from the two. But there's other types of meditation besides mindfulness meditation. There's transcendental meditation, yoga nidra. The list goes on as far as types of meditation that are out there. But, and then sorry, the other circle, mindfulness, that's being very aware of the present moment, the here, the now. And the overlap of the two is where people kind of start to get confused. That's mindfulness meditation. So it's being very intentional about setting aside some time to be mindful. You can meditate mindfully, and you can eat mindfully. You can drive mindfully. Being mindful is just being very focused on the experiences of the here and the now. And then Jon Kabat-Zinn, kind of the father of the Western world or the Western definition of mindfulness, throws in the fact that you're non-judgmental of the here and the now and what it is you're experiencing. So there are definitely misunderstandings of the word mindfulness, and that term is getting thrown around more and more. It's kind of become a buzzword in the past few years. I mean, honestly, that's probably why I got into it, was luckily the counselor and the psychologist was paying attention to the buzzword, and he introduced me to it. So I'm thankful that it is becoming a buzzword and that it is becoming more acceptable. The downside to that is that it's getting misused. Sorry, Mark, I probably spoke too long there, so I'll turn it over to you, what your comments are on that.
Well, I guess mindfulness isn't an app, and an app isn't mindfulness. I'll start off with that. Mindfulness is a way of being. So it's about showing up for life and tuning into your senses and kind of anything and everything that you do, and having this sort of very different relationship with your thoughts, where you're not going to get rid of them, but you can turn down their distraction in taking you away from the present moment. So I think that's very important for people to understand. You can, of course, have a mindset that purely focuses on the informal type of mindfulness and yet still be mindful and still be very beneficial for you. So there's Absolutely. Some things that suit people more than others. Some people like to go on the retreat. Some people like to do very short form meditation. Some people like to do visualization, and that's something that I combine because I think it kind of acts as a catalyst to the whole process. And this sort of self sort of management through, I guess, mental based exercises is a very wide portfolio, as you mentioned, the transcendental stuff, the tuning into your own preferred megahertz sort of vibration in terms of chanting. There's a whole wide range, which does give us all a chance of just finding something that suits us. And of course, John Kabat-Zinn and Mark Williams of Oxford put together the early days of the MBCT, MBSR programs that have become the main training vehicles for mindfulness. But of course, they were both clinical methods. They were to deal with distinct problems. I mean, depression and recurrent depression in terms of the MBCT. And so, of course, the challenge is if one is a teacher nowadays and is one that's going to take this into an audience to share, one needs to translate it in a very different way so that you're not talking to an audience assuming that they've got a problem. Teaching it as sort of a self-management toolkit, I think, is a very, very appropriate way of conveying the strength of these various ways of looking after yourself, and not necessarily including meditation. But if you can include meditation, boy, it's the transformative sort of process.
Oh, absolutely.
I want to put the question back to you, Steve, as a layman that's slightly outside of the mindfulness world. What have you seen it as, you know, as just someone picking it up in some of the things you do?
Well, I think it's really powerful, but I think a lot of people just think it's a simple answer to, you know, I'm just going to do a mindfulness practice, I'm going to practice mindfulness and it will solve my problems.
Yeah.
Whereas it takes more work than that. And I think it should be used in conjunction with other, you know, as part of a more structured process.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
You know, I think there is. I think it can help, as you know, what you talked about before, becoming more present. You know, I think we are so distracted today. More than we've ever been by the world around us, you know, our mobile phones, social media, and, you know, we use the word absent as well as present in the philosophy I come from. So there's an awful lot of people who are absent most of the time, which means not being present. And if you're absent, you're not able to be at your best. You're not able to give your best. Your mind is all over the place. You're focused on worrying about the future or concerned about things that happened in the past. So it's hugely valuable, but it needs to be something more. And this is what I feel the way a lot of people just use these apps as a simple solution rather than saying, well, let's look at the bigger picture. What else can I do? You know, how else can I better self-manage? You know, you talk about mindfulness, fitness, as more than just mindfulness, but as actually empowering the mind and weaponizing it.
You talked about weaponizing the mind. You know, another analogy can be armoring the mind. You can actually develop resilience by practicing these same practices, mindfulness and meditation, because physiologically what happens is the amygdala, so the fight, flight, or freeze part of our brain that's, you know, responsible for that, that has not changed in the millions of years that people have been roaming the earth as far as size, or it hasn't changed dramatically, rather. And that's, I mean, it was a certain size back in ancient times to deal with the stresses and anxiety that, you know, cavemen dealt with. So, you know, you come around the corner, you walk around a boulder and there's a saber-toothed tiger there. You need to be able to respond with your amygdala. You need to be able to fight or run away, right? Well, society has evolved much faster than the human being has and the human mind has, and the amygdala is still responsible quite often for how we react to stimuli. So if that's, you know, a fight on the street, or if it's something more mundane, as in we walk around the office and somebody hands us a task and they say, well, this is due by Friday, well, our instant response is a stress response. That's the default mode that we kick into, and it's our amygdala hijacking our brain. Well, this comes back to the whole reason I'm mentioning this is resilience in practitioners of meditation. Our mind is bouncing around in a million different directions. When we're able to focus it by noticing that your mind is bouncing around, coming back to a mantra, a chant, or focusing on your breath or some bodily sensation, and you do that over and over and over through your meditation, that actually rewires the brain to respond with the prefrontal cortex to stress stimuli rather than with your amygdala. So you're actually going to respond better to those external stress stimuli than you are if you're not a practitioner. So that develops the resilience. So talking about the fear bubble, I haven't read it, but I mean, I'm sure it has some of this similar stuff in there, is that as we're exposed to things that would normally cause fear or normally cause stress, because we've been practitioners, we're not doing away with these stressors. We're not doing away with the threats. We just realize that they are not what we would have at one time perceived them to be, if that makes sense. So, you know, in your listenership, if people are being stressed out by something, or they anticipate being stressed out by something, they can actually develop their response through meditation and mindfulness.
A quick thank you to the Society of Technical Analysts, who this podcast is produced in association with. The Society of Technical Analysts, the STA, are one of the world's leading bodies for the promotion of education and research into the field of technical analysis. You can find out more about their outstanding diploma programs, which are delivered at some of the world's leading academic institutions, or their home study courses by going to their website, sta-uk.org. Now back to the podcast.
The military is starting to implement this in special operations, and we're also starting to implement it even in our general forces as part of boot camp, even, because it does do that. It develops your resilience so that when you are faced with adversity, when you are faced with stress, when you are faced with anxiety, you already know what you can tap into to handle those stressors.
Now, if I can add to that, one of the phrases that I use is to reset, refresh, and recalibrate to gain calmness, clarity, and control. When you're in situations that are so tense, if you've got the ability to do that, you've got the ability to make far, far better decisions and to spot opportunity as well, and threat, I guess. Yeah, very, very interesting. If you were to take yourself back in time, John, back in time to when you were very active as a Navy SEAL commander, and if you used back then what you know now in terms of how you can manage the mind perhaps in a more optimal way, do you think it would have made a massive difference?
I do, definitely. It would have made a difference in a number of things. It would have made a difference in how I responded on the battlefield at the tactical level, because you are constantly aware as you practice mindfulness. I mean, another term for mindfulness is situational awareness. Situational awareness, you're trying to focus on the here and now, right? Well, my situational awareness, because I had wired my brain to be a certain way, I would have been paying more attention on the battlefield. I would have known where my men were in a better way. Not that I was completely scatterbrained, but it would have been better at the tactical level. I would have also, I feel, been more empathetic with not necessarily my enemy per se, but the other people on the battlefield outside of my men. So at times when we may have engaged the enemy and escalated a situation, if we were able to think through it more clearly and with more empathy, we may have not engaged with a weapon and been able to talk through something that didn't need to escalate to the level that it did. So there's that side of things. And then outside of the military side of things, just in personal life, I don't know that I handled things very well as an individual outside of the battlefield, at home, even at work, with friends, with family, because I wasn't in the right state of mind. So I feel, yes, Mark, it definitely would have changed in how I did things in the full sphere of humanity, from the professional to the personal.
Yeah, I remember when I spoke to the Levies when they were in London and did a workshop that I attended, and those are the guys that ran that Pentagon program. They were saying that one of the most sort of interesting sort of letters that they were getting were from the children of the Special Forces men who'd written to the Levies to essentially thank them for bringing their father home. In a mental sense, so that dad was there for us rather than at home but somewhere else. And they said of all the things they got, it was just realizing that they were impacting the family in a very positive way, because of course I guess if that interaction's there, it kind of makes you perform better wherever you are as well, in whatever you do, if you've got that family support.
Absolutely.
You've got that family empathy. So that was something that they very much noticed and had core evidence about.
You gave some examples of your situational awareness in your on duty would have been different. Maybe you can, one, give us some examples from that, if you're allowed to even. You may not be allowed to, and I would understand that. Two, I'm going to sort of then bring it back to the audience that we're talking to here, which is mostly a financial markets audience, but there are people from the broader world. We have people from insurance, people from leadership and management, and even people from other fields of performance and business listening. So I would like maybe you to, if you are able to describe some of these aspects that could have improved how you were in the battlefield. Again, how can people be applying that to their work? So people involved in leadership roles or trading and investment roles.
Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna leave the financial side to you. I'll tell you just generally from the battlefield side, and then maybe you guys can draw an analogy for me, because that is certainly not my expertise, but. I will tell you, so as far as situational awareness on the battlefield, just in general, I mean, I won't get into any specifics, but just in general, what you're having to keep track of as a leader on the battlefield, you have to obviously keep track of your people right there, like literally your people that are, you know, within your sphere of immediate influence. So as a platoon commander, you're paying attention to your platoon of men on the battlefield. You are also reporting to your immediate senior, who may be on a radio in a vehicle back, you know, several hundred yards or several miles back. And then you could theoretically also be communicating to an aircraft above. So you have to pay attention to the assets that are available to you, whether, you know, they're a drone of some sort or a manned aircraft of some sort. You have to know the frequencies that they're all operating on. You have to be able to talk to higher headquarters or other elements that are out there. So if you have a SEAL platoon operating in one battle space, you may have Army Green Berets operating in another battle space, and you need to be able to communicate across those battle spaces to deconflict what's happening. So you have to, you know, you have a tactical level picture, you have an operational level picture, and then you have a much grander strategic level picture. So you're having to pay attention to all these different levels of strategy, operations, and tactics. You have to pay attention to all the different pieces within those different levels, and it gets overwhelming. And some people can almost lock up when there's so much information coming at them. Or they're the ones who are responsible for disseminating that information or for paying attention and tracking all these different assets and things. So in practicing mindfulness and increasing your ability to be more aware of the here and the now, you can actually increase your ability to process that information as it's coming at you, or as you're trying to disseminate that information, your communication skills can actually be improved by practicing meditation and mindfulness, because you're more focused. So there's a lot of parts and pieces to that. I guess as far as in the financial markets and the financial sectors, again, I don't know how that necessarily translates exactly one for one from the battlefield story to what it is, but I'm sure that you have to be, you know, managing a lot of different things going on at the same time, and being able to, I wouldn't say multitask, but when you're doing a task, you are focused on that task. So I'll leave it to you guys to kind of draw the financial market analogy from what I said there. But it's almost as though I'm speaking out of two sides of my mouth, because one thing that I don't encourage is multitasking, because I feel that multitasking actually draws your attention away from things. But I also feel that in practicing mindfulness and meditation, when you are multitasking, you are able to switch those tasks quicker and in a more efficient and more effective way. So that's where it comes into play in the battle space, is that you're able to do a lot of things almost simultaneously, and the time to switch from one task to the next is reduced. And then what you're able to focus on while you are on a particular task, you're more focused.
Yeah, that's almost the weaponizing of the mind, which Mark talks about so often. Because you're saying suddenly you're so much more capable. And you're capable of doing all these things. And it was interesting, because maybe I missed it, but as you were describing that huge complexity going on around you, all these different streams of communications that you need to be paying attention to, and the people who are under you. And, you know, first of all, I'm thinking in terms of complexity, financial markets, and then I'm thinking leadership as well. But you've not even mentioned, which is, of course, the other thing, is the engagement with the enemy. This is just the actual job.
Yes.
I mean, you've got so much going on. I always wonder, how do you then cope with that when you have to engage with the enemy? And I'm curious about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I will be honest, I have only in my entire career, I have only fired one round at an enemy. And the reason I attribute that to is that I was a leader on the battlefield, and I feel that if I am shooting on the battlefield, then I have lost my focus on what is important as a leader. And the people that are around me are the ones who should be shooting, and I am the one who, or one of the ones who should be paying attention to the whole situation. So that's a quick just anecdote there about my battlefield experience. But as far as engaging the enemy, I mean, it becomes a natural kind of muscle memory in the special operations. You train to it. You almost, and this is going to sound kind of cold, but you almost dehumanize the enemy by your training that you go through. I mean, you're shooting at paper that is shaped like a human being. You're shooting at targets that are shaped like human beings, and they just become targets to you. And then only after the fact, after you kind of get out of the adrenaline, the moment of the battlefield, do you really realize what it is you have been involved in. So that piece, There are so many layers there, Stephen, to go through, and it's definitely different per individual. But I am in a way blessed in that I didn't have to engage the enemy as often as some may on the battlefield.
If you're stressed or negative mindset, you're working in silos. But if you've got a positive mindset and you're tuned into your environment, you're working as a team, and you become a collective. So certainly from a business world point of view, we talk about it creating the mental capital of your business. You know, it's beyond the sum of the parts, but as well as the thought process and the sort of innovation that comes out of that connectivity, you've also got this team flourishing that occurs, and the sense that you're not in a silo. And I think some of the traders that we speak about, those that might be operating in some sort of e-isolation, have got to work upon themselves particularly hard just to make sure they keep their sort of mental credentials. I imagine on the battlefield, the last thing you want to be is to be siloed. You want to be part of the team, otherwise you're totally at risk.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we talk about the Stanley McChrystal and the team of teams. I'm sure you guys have read that, you know, the silos or the breaking down of the silos in the special operations world. That has been critical, again, going back to those whole, the different parts and layers of combat. You've got the tactical, you've got the operational and strategic, breaking down those silos. Much of what Team of Teams is about is breaking those silos down at kind of the operational and strategic level. But absolutely, you have to have those silos broken down at the tactical level too, at the very lowest level, from one man to the next. You have to be able to communicate and kind of almost know what one another is thinking. And then from one unit to the next, being able to communicate on the battlefield, going back to those decompliction points with, you know, if you're operating in close proximity to another unit, you absolutely have to have the ability to communicate not only up and down, but side to side and laterally.
That team of teams aspect, which you just mentioned, and maybe we're going slightly off mindfulness, but I can see why it's so important, breaking down silos. That's a huge thing in the world we operate within. You know, there's, you know, one of the biggest challenges for businesses in the financial markets is to try and work in ways which are better than the silo way. They realize there's advantages to working in silos, but also many disadvantages. But I'm really curious about this team of teams aspect.
Yeah, so Stanley McChrystal, his book, Team of Teams, is all about when he took over command of special operations in the in Iraq, he broke down the silos by having what he called an ops and intel, an operations and intelligence synchronization video teleconference regularly. And I'm obviously distilling this book down very, very much, but basically in this video teleconference that he had daily, anybody that had any information could share it with the entire group at once, because all these different units patched into this conference, and anybody could ask questions. So if one person provided an intel like nugget of information, some other unit may ask about that. It wasn't just to brief General McChrystal, which a lot of our conferences end up being is a brief to the commander. These were more of a what some people call as leveling the bubbles, or, you know, basically flattening the communication, flattening the hierarchy of the military structure. because communication just flowed everywhere there. And in doing so, in having those teams of teams, rather than just having silos, information got disseminated faster and operations were able to be done in a more effective and efficient manner so that we could stay ahead of our enemy, because they had to decentralize. The enemy in overseas had a decentralized communication network, right? They don't have a hierarchy. They just pass information as they can. Well, that's a little bit about the kind of the team of teams. So yeah, we definitely got off the track there, but I fully fault myself for that in bringing up team of teams. But it's a fascinating read if you haven't read it yet, and there's definitely value in communicating that way. There's times when it's difficult because there's so much information coming in, but there's definitely value in it at other times.
Yeah, there's personal mindfulness and there's system mindfulness as well. So the system can have a mindful philosophy behind its structure, because it does, and we've seen it does work at a system level, and that's the corporate opportunity. And I guess that's the from a collective of the military, that's also their thinking as to why they see this stuff as being beyond just supporting, you know, the man in the field, a man in theater. It's big. It's a bigger story than that.
You talked earlier on about stress and anxiety and fear, which is ever present, I guess, in your line of work, or has been. As we're talking about this, the fear o-meter has exploded through the roof in the past couple of weeks. Coronavirus is sweeping across the world, and of course the financial markets in the past 2-3 weeks have been in a sort of a fear bubble of their own, and a lot of people are very stressed, a lot of people are very anxious. You know, maybe you could describe how mindfulness helped you with that in a little bit, again, a little bit more personal, maybe a little bit more how it actually made you feel, rather than just describing kind of what you did.
Oh, sure. So, I'll just be completely honest with you, is that I used to stress out a lot about the smallest things. I was almost obsessive compulsive planner. I still am in a way, but I try to do it with less stress and anxiety. But my stress response was, as soon as somebody would give me some very simple task, I would start thinking about how to accomplish that task perfectly. And in doing so, in thinking about that, my stress level my stress response was extreme. I would start having rough nights. I wouldn't sleep well. My hands would sweat. My heart rate would be increased. My blood pressure would be increased. And ultimately, I had a lot of tension in my body. Once I got introduced to mindfulness and meditation, when somebody would assign me something, I would try to take a few deep breaths. This is going back to those immediate responses, positive responses that you can have through meditation and mindfulness. I would take a few deep breaths in and then slow breath out. That taps into the parasympathetic nervous system. So you're able to bring your heart rate back down. You're able to bring your blood pressure back down. Able to kind of calm your stress responses. And in doing so, I found that I was still able to think about how to do that task well, but I wasn't stressed about it to the point where I didn't sleep at night. So I was getting sleep. I was more focused through the days because I had rest. And all in all, I was physically and mentally more healthy. So that's not, I guess, if you want to call that fear, I think that's a fear in a way. I also, in post-traumatic stress, I have been hyper-vigilant about a lot of things in my life. So being in crowds, I wasn't comfortable in that regard. Going into a restaurant had to sit with my face towards the entrance as much as possible, or have a conversation with whoever else I was with, saying, hey, look, you have to keep an eye on the entrances and exits, because I was hypervigilant. Now I feel that I am much more relaxed and less anxious, so I am able to go into those situations comfortably, not just go into those situations, but I even host situations where I host events where I bring in a crowd of people that I don't know. And that anxiety, that level of fear, if you will, has completely been reduced. It's not completely gone. I don't know that it can ever be completely gone, and I don't know that I ever want it completely gone, but it has definitely been greatly reduced.
See, to me, that talks about the power of what mindfulness is. You know, it almost sounds like your brain has been reframed in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely has.
That is such a hard thing to do. I mean, you know, it could have saved so many, you could almost say millions of people's, you know, mental health and physical health and well-being and relationships. So, I mean, it sounds like there's probably a positive benefit to people in your life as well, your family and friends.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've got two little ones, like I mentioned at the beginning of the show, and I'm able, when I'm with them, to not just be with them physically, but to be with them mentally. And the same can be said for when I'm with my, you know, when I'm with my wife. I am with her physically and mentally. My mind is not at work. My mind is not, you know, 3 weeks into the future or worrying about something that I messed up 3 weeks ago in the past. My mind is right there with her, or at least it's more so. There are still times. I am by no means a perfect mindfulness expert. I am always working at it, and there's still times when my mind does wander off, and it will always. But I am more present than I was before. I am more present with my family, my children, my wife. I feel that I'm more present in conversations with my friends. I feel that I'm more present in conversations with strangers, quite honestly. I mean, I would say a few years ago, I wouldn't be able to go onto a podcast like this and carry on a coherent conversation, because my mind would be wandering elsewhere. And if you were to ask me questions, I would answer them, but I don't know that the conversation would be something that you would want to publish. It would be kind of all over the place, and there would be a lot of ums and ahs, and not very well thought out, make a whole lot of sense. But I feel that I've definitely improved in my communication abilities and my being present in the here and now with friends, family, coworkers, and with complete strangers too. So, yeah.
I think once we can get past this idea of it being something which is a little bit, I think, you know, there's still quite a lot of people very uncomfortable about it. They don't feel it's particularly, how can I use the words? It's particularly, well, I was going to say rugby, but I know some rugby clubs are starting to use it here in the UK. And you would have said that's the last thing you would expect a rugby team to be doing. But this is the whole point. We're starting to, you know, people are starting to look at performance now holistically. And performance in everything, as we say, in leadership, in what you do in financial markets, in business, and thinking, you know, where does the edge come from? You know, there's so much stress and pressure from the market, from technology, from the world around us, that we put on ourselves as well. I think this is just going to be a huge growth area. I think a lot of the younger people are much more into it already. And I can only see this, you know, the way you described it there was, you know, I'm sitting there thinking, everyone must be listening to this thinking, where do I get this from? You know, so how do you raise that? When, you know, when people come to you, the work you're doing with Path sounds extraordinary.
Well, I deal with it a few ways. So not so much about Veterans Path in and of itself, but just writ large, in, like you mentioned, in this day and age, we are, I think, we are under unbelievable amounts of stress but it is so much self-induced because of, like you mentioned before, constantly being connected to our cell phones, constantly being connected to social media, the fear of missing out of what other people are doing, or the perception that other people's lives are perfect when ours are not, because of social media. Because who's going to post a whole lot of stuff that's going on negatively in their lives? They're not going to post a lot of that. I mean, sure, there are some people who do, but a lot of what people post is, look at how great my life is. And that's what other people see. And so when you see that, you believe, you compare yourself. It's the old keeping up with the Joneses, but it's being exponentially worse, right? Because we're constantly inundated with how perfect everybody else's life is. And then also being constantly connected to work. So our work email is connected to our phone. Our bosses have our cell phone numbers. They text us, they email us. Our coworkers text us and email us at all times of day, all times through the night. When we wake up in the morning, what's the first thing most of us do? We roll over, and instead of, you know, rolling over and kissing our significant other that's in bed with us, we roll over and we check our cell phones to see what's happened in the 6-8 hours, whatever it is, that we've been sleeping. And we look at all the notifications, we look at the emails, we look at the banks, we look at social media. And before we know it, we're an hour into our day and we're already stressed out because of our phones. So
yeah, you're sounding like a trader, yeah. John.
Yeah, I mean, we have similar stresses. As I honestly do trade, but I wouldn't consider myself a trader, and I am certainly not going to touch the markets these days right now with what's going on. In all honesty, if I had money, I would invest now.
One of the biggest problems for many traders is this fear of missing out, and that there's this whole thing on Twitter and Instagram where people who are really just selling and marketing, they're not trading, are putting out there how much money they're making. And, you know, they'll say, oh, I made 5,000 today, or got it right, bought the bottom, sold the top. And we know it's nonsense. We know they're just salespeople trying to sell a system. Because real traders don't do that. You know, I've been a trader for nearly 25 years. For the last 10 years, I've worked coaching traders. And I can't think of a really successful trader, a real trader I know, who would even discuss that. You know, or play it for a minute. So we know it's bullshit, but we do hear it's when you see it, you believe it. And that's part of the problem.
Yep. I could definitely see that. I mean, it is that fear of missing out, and probably some younger crowd may not realize that is a load of crap. And feel that they are in fact missing out on reality, when in fact that's not reality at all.
But this goes back to that point about presence. It's moving them away from being present. But rather than being there for themselves and focusing on what they should do, what they need to do, they're worrying that they're missing out, that somebody else is making a load of money, that suddenly they're inferior and they're not up to the task.
Right.
And then that's where we say they become absent and not present.
Absolutely.
Does that happen on the, again, you talking about the battlefield, but the battlefield is a very broad term, as you described earlier on. Does anything like that happen on the battlefield?
Yeah, I would say to a different level. Yeah, it does. Trying to think of a specific example, but yes, I would say that it does happen at times.
I could tell you one thing I read about, actually, that was like that, and it was in Ant Middleton's book, The Fear Bubble, and he talked about leading a group. They were on a mission in Afghanistan, in one of the most volatile regions, and he was leading a group of soldiers, special forces soldiers, through some streets in this Afghanistani town. And he said, suddenly I didn't know where I was. I'd lost my way. And
yeah.
He looked back at all the guys, and the guys are following him, and he's thinking, I can only admit I've lost my way and lead them into a death trap. Or I can pretend and hope they don't notice. And he went, yeah. At that point, my ego kicked in, and I like, for a second, I thought, well, let's just carry on and hope they don't notice. And that's when he was talking about ego, because ego and fear are very close. And then he said, no, he went, guys, I've just got to tell you, I've screwed up here. And they went, we thought so. We didn't know where we were going. It's a great bit in the book. But he said there was a scenario where it was possible that his ego could have caused him to lead this whole group into a death trap.
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely, I could see that happening. And especially amongst type A personalities who are very aggressive and are apprehensive about admitting when they're wrong, which, you know, you will find a large percentage of the special operations forces are type A personalities. So you can see that. Luckily we do have some layers that can protect us from that, as far as being connected with our higher headquarters or having other people in the platoon that are also, you know, checking their GPSs and other things. So, you know, sometimes as a leader, or as an officer rather, our senior enlisted will straighten us out pretty quickly and say, hey, sir, you know, maybe we need to go this way instead of that way, because we are in fact leading the platoon into a space where we don't know, or into an ambush. So I, as a platoon commander, as an officer, I lean very heavily on my senior enlisted. But again, that's neither here nor there. But just a point there is that there's redundancy within the military that does help to protect from that type of thing. But yes, I could see an instance where ego could definitely get the better of people on the battlefield.
John, I think we're delighted to have had you on today. It's been a pleasure, John. So we can only end by wishing you well and stay safe.
Thank you guys so much. I sincerely appreciate, again, the opportunity to come on the show, share a little bit about Veterans Path and what it is they do and we do. And furthermore, in the opportunity to share a little bit about mindfulness and the benefits thereof, and I hope that some of your listeners are able to try these life-changing and life-saving practices out, because I do firmly believe that they do make a positive impact on our lives, our minds, and who we are and how we handle things. So thanks again, guys. I certainly appreciate the opportunity.
And John, one final thing. How can people find out about you and learn about you?
Sure. I am, as Mark well knows, I'm fairly active on LinkedIn, and you can find me there. It's just John McCaskill, spelled J-O-N, as my first name, John, and my last name is spelled M-A-C-A-S-K-I-L-L. And if you look me up there, I am I think I'm the only John McCaskill Navy SEAL commander on LinkedIn. So you should be able to find me there. And then I'm also, you can email me at John, J-O-N, at veteranspath.org. So John, J-O-N, at veteranspath.org.
Thank you, John. This has been terrific. And I echo everything Mark said. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening today. And what a great guest John was. If you're interested in knowing more about how we can help you deliver powerful mindfulness programs and webinars about the themes brought up in today's podcast, my co-host Mark Randall is globally respected for running transformative mind fitness programs at some of the world's leading companies. Mark's unique mind fitness program helps build mental strength and develops mental armor for performing at optimum levels and surviving in complex, fast-moving, multidimensional environments. Mark also has huge experience in the financial markets, having worked for almost four decades as a broker at NatWest Markets and Greenwich Capital. To know more about Mark, visit markrandallconsultancy.com. If you are interested in our powerful trader performance coaching programs, these are delivered by myself, Stephen Goldstein. I've been coaching traders at some of the world's leading trading and investment firms, as well as private traders, for over a decade. Before that, I worked for almost 25 years as a trader at some of the world's leading investment banks. The programs I deliver help people unleash their potential as traders and investment professionals and facilitate the development of the key mental aspects of trading performance, which provides such a vital trading and investing edge. The Alpha Mind Trader Performance Program is based on these programs I've been delivering to traders and investment professionals at some of the world's leading firms. For more details on the Alpha Mind Trader Performance Program, please email info@alpharcubed.com. That is the word alpha, the letter R, and the word cubed.com. Also, check out our blog page by Googling Alpha Mind Blog or going direct to alphamindblog.blogspot.com. There is a link at the top of the landing page about the Alpha Mind Trader Performance Coaching Program. If you have enjoyed this podcast, we would be delighted if you can rate and even review the show on iTunes or whichever service you use. Ratings help raise awareness of our show to a much wider audience. We appreciate these are very strange and unsettling times in so many ways. In response, we are planning to launch some free webinars over the next few weeks with a view to helping people cope with the stress-inducing anxiety of the coronavirus, quarantine and isolation, as well as worrying about their loved ones, and also for those who have been struggling and challenged by the extremely volatile and wild financial markets of the past few weeks. We will be announcing details of these on our social media pages, so please keep an eye out for these. Our social media pages are predominantly on LinkedIn and Twitter, where myself and Mark will be happy to connect with you. On LinkedIn, it is Stephen Goldstein and Mark Randall. We also have an active LinkedIn group called the Alpha Mind Group. You can also follow us on Twitter at AlphaMind101 is my handle, and Mark's is at AlphaMind102. As mentioned before, we also have a blog, alphamindblog.blogspot.com, and you can find out more about us on the page alpha-mind.net. Finally, once again, thank you to the STA, the Society of Technical Analysts, who this show is produced in association with. The STA are an incredible organisation who provide powerful home study courses and diplomas created by some of the leading figures in the investing industry. As a non-profit body, they go back over 50 years and are a hugely trusted provider of trader education services. Please also be sure to tune in and subscribe to next week's episode, where we talk to the fantastic performance coach, Denise Shaw, who inspired the character Wendy in the TV show Billions. In the meantime, we wish you and your families well, and please stay safe.